The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right. Welcome, everyone. I hope you're having a great conference and day today. I know that it's been an exciting, jammed weekend already, so we're really looking forward to speaking with you about the issue of language rights in our community. My name is Kelly Shaw, and I serve as the Executive Director at TACI for South Asian Youth, which exists at the Washington campus. And I'm going to briefly introduce our great panelists, and then we're just going to dive in terms of the issue of language in our community. So Nisha Agarwal is an attorney at the New York Lawyers for the Public Interest. And what's very exciting is she has a recent victory around the issue of language access to share with us in terms of particularly the self-care context, which is the arena that she works in. So we're very excited to have her here with us. Nadia Ferozzi is a D.C. local, so we're very excited to have her. She works at the Agency of American Legal Resource Center and has been working around the issue of language access and advocacy, particularly around D.C.'s local law and the various parameters of that. So we'll get to hear a lot more in terms of how we actually get language access on a day-to-day level from Nadia. And then last, of course, but not least, is Jay Lutra, who's the Executive Director at the Indo-American Council in Chicago. So we'll hear from a slightly different perspective to round out our panel in terms of provision of services to limited English proficient individuals and how to actually enable English language learning and other barriers. So we're very excited that Jay can bring us that perspective. And we're definitely going to have time. I know we'll have a little bit of an abbreviated session because we're starting slightly late, but we will certainly have time for your feedback, questions, and discussion, because that's always very, very important. So I'd love to actually just start off by getting a sense of how many folks here are multilingual. If you could just raise your hand. Hi. Great. And you guys can do it. Great. Fabulous. So how many folks speak more than two languages? We got some winners in the audience. Very, very impressive. How about four? Okay, so now we got another point. But that is really, really impressive. So, you know, in terms of thinking about the South Asian community, one of the things that we often think about is the diversity of languages. We know within our community not only are there a number of major South Asian languages, but there are hundreds of other regional languages, dialects, and so within our community there's a diversity just from the way in which we speak, not even about English itself as well. So as we think about language, we know that language is also tied to culture, to identity, and fundamentally in terms of what we will discuss today, about not only integration into American society and becoming a civic and political presence, but also accessing much-needed services. So information that you may or may not know is that in terms of looking at the 2000 census, when we look at the issue of language access, we see that there's a significant pool of the American population that does not speak English fluently. We refer to folks in this capacity as limited English proficient. So if we use the term LEP throughout the session, that's what we're referring to. Within our community, what's very interesting to know is that about half among the issue community members are limited English proficient. About a third of Pakistani community members, and about a quarter of Indian community members. So it's really amazing to think that such a significant portion of our community may face challenges navigating U.S. society because of language barriers. So if we look at the general American population, what we know from the 2005 American Community Survey is that about 17 million American people residing in America are limited English proficient. So, of course, we haven't been thinking about the issue of language access for a very long time, which results in a number of situations and problems. So I'd love first, actually, to open to our panel and have each of you describe some of the ways in which you see language and language access emerging in your day-to-day life.
So as Corey mentioned, most of my work focuses on the healthcare context, so that's where language access barriers that I encounter with my clients tend to be in the healthcare spoke Mandarin, and so did her husband. And while during the delivery process, from the beginning to the end of the delivery process, did not receive an interpreter of any sort, signed all sorts of consent forms in English, they had no idea what these consent forms said. Not only that, the delivery process became complicated, and there was no communication between the woman and her physicians. So the physicians were basically guessing as to what might be going wrong from her perspective. Long story short, her child was born but with severe developmental disabilities. When the child actually sort of came out, he was blue, and they had to rush the baby away and took him to another hospital for urgent care. The parents had no idea what was happening, again, because of the language barrier. So some really horrific things can come from simply not having an interpreter in the room in the healthcare setting. Other examples that I've worked on have been related to language access in pharmacies. So a lot of my clients are parents who go to the pharmacist to get medications for their kids because they're sick, and they get a couple, two or three medications. When they get home, they can't read the prescription labels, so they don't remember how to administer. Do I actually administer this orally? Do I administer it topically to my child, to myself? And that can result in lots of adverse impacts as well. So in the healthcare setting, there's really sometimes it can be a matter of life and death if you don't address the language barrier, and that's the main way in which I encounter it. And then as an attorney, I encounter it, of course, in working with my clients and trying to navigate that barrier, whether clients are calling me, and I only speak one other language, so you know, most of the time I need to use some interpretation services to communicate with my clients. But also when they're signing a retainer agreement, when any sort of basic documentation related to the attorney-client relationship is involved, we have to constantly be vigilant thinking about translating the documents, but also the quality of translation, making sure that the client understands what their rights and responsibilities
are. So basically what Nisha said, kind of, you know, that's basically what I do as well. Just not really on the health setting. I think honestly, healthcare is an enormous beast, really. And so the work that she's doing, I can't even tell you how monumental actually the work that she's doing is. It's phenomenal, phenomenal work. Most of the language access work that I end up doing is much more on the local level. In DC, here we're going to talk about it a little bit later, but there is a language access law, quite a comprehensive language access law. So I come across individuals all the time, and my organization really works with the broader API community, the broader Asian Pacific Islander community, and one of my students is back over there also. So, I just want to point him out.
You can come sit.
But so, while she's obviously looking at it from very much the healthcare perspective, I see individuals who are applying for food stamps and are not able to access their food stamps and are receiving notices in the mail, for example, from DC government, stating that if they don't apply to renew their food stamps in 10 days, they're going to lose their food stamps. And then I also have individuals who come into my office, a Mandarin speaker actually recently came into my office, who had that letter in her hand and had taken out her Mandarin English dictionary and tried to translate word for word for word what the notice said. And I mean, it took her 7 days just to get through, like, you know, paragraph one with all the other things that she's doing. So what ends up happening is that they'll, you know, an individual may not necessarily know that, you know, they'll see the number 10 and have no idea what that means, or they don't really know what's in their notice and are not able to really apply for the things that they should be able to apply for. Because ultimately, you know, language access really is making sure that individuals who don't speak English very well get the same services as individuals who do speak English very well. And unfortunately, it doesn't happen that often. So we see it in the context of food stamps. I've dealt with individuals who've been incarcerated within the DC sort of system, the DC Department of Corrections. I've also seen it in relation to applying for business licenses. A number of the dry cleaning establishments in the DC area are Korean owned. And in order to actually operate a dry cleaner, you have to pass a test to actually use the machine. And the test is only in English, and the licensing and the application forms are only in English. And most of these individuals are LEP, are limited English proficient. So do they have the same access as individuals who do speak English? And then you also come across, you know, when government agencies and when government investigators come out to their site and they don't have they don't necessarily have their documentation, they don't have their license, does that government agent actually bring an interpreter with them? There's all kinds of things, and it's like living in an airport all the time, really. That's the only way that I can describe it. You know, my mother doesn't speak English very well. I mean, actually, she speaks English pretty darn well when she wants to. I mean, you know, here now. But, you know, I used to live, I lived in Europe for about a year, and I remember I was 19 years old, and I was, and the story, every time I think about laryngitis, I was sitting in an airport in Hamburg in Germany, and I literally had no clue where I was going. I mean, literally. I took German in high school, and I was like, I know this. I totally know this. And I remember looking up at the signs, and I was like, I'm Jack. This is horrible. And that's, I mean, it's being in that state all the time. But again, the work that I do is very much the same that Nisha is doing in terms of dealing with clients and utilizing interpreters, representation agreements, kind of things like that. So that's kind of some stuff that I'm doing here in this area.
Indo-American Center is a direct service provider. We're located in Chicago on Vaughan Avenue, which is the center of the South Asian population. Our mission is to help South Asians integrate better within broader American society. And when you think of integration, the first thing that comes to mind, at least my mind, is language. So we help our clients with the English language. English is a second language class, ESL classes, and so forth. But the clients don't come to us just to learn English. They come to learn English, but that is not the reason they are coming. The reason is something else. So more than half of our clients are coming because they want to do either better in an existing job, or they want to get a job, which is their first job. About a third of our clients, or maybe 30% of our clients, are coming because they want to become a citizen. And then there are other reasons. For example, one of the clients told us they want to come and learn some English because they want to talk to the teachers of their kids and be able to communicate. So there's a whole host of goals. Our goal in teaching them English is to help them with their life goal, not necessarily just for the English. And so the ESL classes kind of form the center around which their whole host of other services provide. Try and accomplish that integration. For example, we provide, for those who want to get a job, we have a pilot program going, and we're seeking funding to expand it, and the program is providing soft skills for employability training. For those who want to become citizens, we can help them with filing their applications. We can help them with learning civics to pass the test, in addition to, of course, ESL. So we have a host of services. And somebody here mentioned about access to services. But whether you're coming at the English language from the direction that has been described here by Nadia and Nisha, or whether you're coming at it from our side, what you're really looking for, and I think Nadia mentioned that, is access to services. So you can either learn English and get the same access to services, or you can do the activism and the translations and other things to get the same access to services. There's just two sides of the same equation.
Thank you, Jim. Can you actually build a little bit on that and just talk about what you see in terms of the availability of English as second language classes? You know, do you feel that the community members you serve have other options as well in terms of gaining that skill, or do you see that as a challenge? And then maybe to follow up on that, Nisha and Nadia, if you can talk a little bit about, you know, what rights there might be in terms of language access. Because I know as we think about immigration reform, one of the huge pieces of the conversation has been not only the place of immigrants, but also the place of the English language. You know, across the country, that there are many states and localities that sometimes are putting in language access laws, and on the other hand, sometimes trying to advocate for English-only practices. So if we can talk a little bit about what might be the parameters legally and also some of the on-the-ground availability, that would be great for us to open up a little bit.
So the question on availability of, let's say, ESL classes. My guess is, and this is just a wild guess, that if all the people who really need those classes actually pursued them, they will be, we'll be out of capacity very shortly. And so will be all the other areas, all the other agencies, all the other community colleges and so on will be out of capacity shortly. In other words, the feeling is that not all people who need this help are seeking. We try to do our part by doing the outreach in and around the community we are in. Transportation is clearly a big problem. Our services are free. So there's a natural attraction for our clients to come to our center. But they can't come from the suburb. They can't come from south side of Chicago. Or they can't come from some other area. Because if they are LEPs, they presumably have either no job or a low paying job. And that presumably means they don't have access to transportation, access to a car. So the good news is that all those that want, that seek our help, we are able to provide that to them right now. That's the good news. The bad news is there are many others who need this help who are not going to be.
Sure. So in terms of rights that are available to people who are limited English proficient for services, on the federal level, the legal framework is actually based on Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So rights have really been in place for a long time. And under Title VI, basically there's just one sentence that's very important, and I can't quote it off the top of my head, which is a little embarrassing, not given how many times I've read it. But it says something to the effect of no person, and that includes both citizens and non-citizens, shall be subject to discrimination on the basis of race, color, or national origin by any program or entity that receives federal financial assistance. So the idea when Title VI was introduced, when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was introduced, John F. Kennedy called it simple justice, that if millions of taxpayer dollars are going to an organization to provide whatever kind of services, it could be a hospital, it could be anything else, they shouldn't be discriminating against the people who are paying those taxes, and they shouldn't exclude anybody. There's two different forms of discrimination that are prohibited under Title VI. One is intentional discrimination, so I see that you are Indian or Pakistani or Bangladeshi, and I'm going to deny you services. That's intentional. That's not really where language access comes from. The language access discrimination is what's called disparate impact discrimination, and that means that the conduct is neutral as to race or national origin. So not providing an interpreter. There's no protection in the law for interpreters, per se. But if you don't provide an interpreter, who are you effectively excluding from the services? People based on race and national origin. And so that's kind of the federal framework for all of this. And the way language actually fits into it is that there was a case by the Supreme Court in 1974 dealing with Chinese-speaking students in San Francisco. And the court said that national origin includes language. And so ever since then, there's been a relationship, at least at the federal level, between national origin and language. To that, I mean, partly, really in 1964, the demographics of this country were really, race was about black and white, but after immigration laws were changed in that period, also in response to the civil rights movement, you've seen such an increase in diversity. And so really, a lot of the enforcement around language access only started in recent decades, and actually in 2000, aboard Air Force One, President Clinton signed an executive order requiring all federal agencies to issue guidance about language access to all of the people, all of the organizations that receive federal financial assistance from them. So if you go on the website of any federal agency that you might, your clients might receive services from, you can see the guidance, which is very detailed about what the agencies and federal fund recipients should be doing. And that's a really useful resource for anybody looking to learn more about the rights that their clients or communities might have. And I also recommend to you the website LAP.gov, which has a lot of this information on it as well.
And then on the local level, so for example, D.C. Has what's called the 2004 D.C. Language Access Act, which is probably the most comprehensive language access law in the country. And there's four other places, four other, I guess, localities that have language access. One is Hawaii, one is San Francisco, and the other three I honestly don't remember right now. And I'm sure Nisha does actually, but I don't remember off the top of my head right now. But what the act does is it's very much in line with Title VI and the executive orders. And so what it does is it mandates DC government to provide equal access to services. And in order to provide that equal access, they have to provide interpretation and translation of what are called vital services and vital documents. One of the legal questions becomes what's a vital service and what's a vital document. But the other component of the law is that it actually states six languages that things need to be translated in. And this is actually based on the number of individuals that a DC sort of agency sees. There are 35 district government agencies that all sort of fall under the mayor's office. The DC government is really kind of its own sort of system. It's very unique from other sort of state systems. So everything falls under kind of, you know, the power of the offices of the mayor's office, and then you've got these other sort of agencies. So there are 35 agencies. And the way that the act worked, the way that the Language Access Act worked, was that over the course of several years, there would be what we call phase compliance, where different agencies would have to, provide basically kind of guidance, essentially, what we call them language access plans or biannual language access plans, we call them BLAPs, where different agencies are supposed to provide what their plan will be in order to effectively, you know, sort of communicate and serve the LEP community. In D.C., 15% of the District of Columbia is considered LEP, and 17% of that 15%, which is bizarre math, speaks a different language other than English at home, just a completely different language. So that's a staggering number when you really think about it. And so from the context, and Nisha had mentioned sort of intentional discrimination versus kind of the disparate impact, the DC law really deals with the disparate impact issue because that's really what's available in terms of remedial measures. You can bring what's called an administrative complaint if you find that an individual has been denied services by not being provided with some sort of language assistance. So while it's not necessarily a lawsuit, for example, it's not one where you're going to come out with some sort of money or you're going to come out with some sort of, you know, monetary damages or anything like that, but it can lead to some really positive systemic change. It can lead to the government essentially admitting that they have violated Title VI, or they have violated something, they violated the Language Access Act, and we're now going to provide interpretation and translation. We're now going to write up these plans. We're now going to, you know, write up a guidance of what it is that we're going to do. We're now going to learn how to use interpreters, kind of things like that. So that's really what's happening on the local level. And luckily in D.C. we have a very comprehensive law. We also, the problem that we're seeing is that we have many agencies who don't know about the law and don't know what their responsibilities are. And so that's kind of the push and pull that we're in.
So I'm going to take a hat break, actually, before we move into sort of strategy for and access, to see if you have any questions, comments, that we, based on this first part of the discussion. Yeah.
Nisha, is it correct to understand that after the court, I think, in the Chinese case you mentioned, that national origin includes language access? Is it okay to say that language access would be a fundamental right? Is that okay to say that?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure that it would sort of rise to the level of sort of fundamental right in that sense. And one sort of tricky thing is that at the federal level, you have the case law that says that language is a component of national origin or is a proxy for national origin. In New York, that's not true at the state level or the local level. So that's something that's sort of, so in terms of the issue of fundamental right, it hasn't trickled down to the localities, at least not in New York. And so that's something that, as advocates, we're working on, and as a lawyer, I'm particularly interested in. But it's sort of, that was a really seminal case, and it was coming out of a particular historical period. I would be very surprised if the Supreme Court ever came up with a similar sort of, you know, meaning of the law.
Right, so just to follow up with that, sorry. So if in localities like New York that has not stated that language access is a fundamental right, can you recall any arguments from the state side claiming that because it's not a fundamental right, we're going to use rational basis instead of strict scrutiny and say that the state has a legit interest in not providing the access?
We haven't seen those types of arguments in exactly that formulation, but that's pretty much always the argument you get from the other side. Whether it's, I work mainly, sort of, my adversaries can be private entities like private hospitals or pharmacies, but to the extent that we work with agencies and with government, they will say that it's too costly, which is kind of a rational basis. Like they have a lot of seemingly legitimate arguments, counter arguments, from not providing language access. And so that's when the sort of power of being able to talk about civil rights or human rights or immigrant rights or any of the rights-based framework can be really useful. And in our office, we have a law and organizing model, so it's not just litigation and lawyers, but we have community groups that are mobilized around this issue. And that can be politically and sort of organizationally very powerful to have that as a response to some of the rational basis type arguments.
And I would just add to that in terms of, if you look at LAP.gov, so this civil rights compliance
falls under the Department of Justice, their coordination review office. So they have what is called a four-factor test in terms of assessing. And of those four factors, you're going to look at demographics, the need and criticalness of the issue itself, and one of the factors is also reasonableness and the resources available to that particular entity. So that's also why, in fact, many entities, whether private or public, can go back to the four-factor test and say, you know, this is actually unreasonable, or our demographic, you know, minimum isn't really met here in terms of this particular community. So you'll also see why in the local laws, there might be six language groups that are protected and explicitly named, but not necessarily other language groups, which is critical for our communities because we're often, if not almost always, not part of the six languages that are part of the protected even local laws. So when you look at South Asian and some APA communities, that's not going to be a factor of consideration at times. So that's why also the community organizing piece is really essential, because as a community organizing mechanism, you can work to get local institutions more responsive to your community's language needs, even if they don't rise to the demographic level of other agencies. I think one of the reasons that we at TECHI, South Asian Women, began looking at the issue of language access was from the rights-based framework, because what we were seeing as staff or volunteers that are accompanying survivors of violence to court is that oftentimes those who needed court interpreters, either they were just scheduling issues, like a court interpreter didn't show up. Sometimes the interpreter was a Punjabi-speaking interpreter, but really we needed an Urdu-speaking interpreter. And then at the very kind of scale of the breaches, at times what we would see is that sometimes interpreters would reflect their own gender bias and even say to women, you should drop this custody case because the kids belong with the father, or they would sexually or physically harass people who were using court to access justice. So that's why it's useful to both have the framework of what is legally entitled at this point, but also the perspective of, you know, what is the health system supposed to do, or what is the court system supposed to do, and then really enable sort of that practical argument as well. And I would say from our perspective, I think the healthcare community has come quite a long way. There's so much more to do. But one of the reasons that the healthcare community is even working to develop standards around interpretation is that malpractice is such an issue, right? So when you go back to the cost basis, it's either you do the work right the first time or you might get the same malpractice. So similarly, I think within the court system, we're trying to look at some of those rationales as well, because there's obviously, in criminal cases, it's understandable what the cost is, because it could be life or death, right? But when you work on civil cases, if there are family law issues or if there are immigration law issues, sometimes you have to really communicate to people, this is a life-changing matter for somebody. So it has to, you have to also have that kind of conversation as well.
Are there any particular states which have, like, stand out as having been really progressive on this issue, either in terms of what's required or money that they've put behind it?
I would say California has some really great laws. They just recently passed a law requiring health insurance plans to be completely accessible, and they have a range of different laws in that respect. I really think California is a standout.
Hawaii definitely does as well. Hawaii is amazing. It's a really amazing state, actually, when you really think about it also. But, you know, there is a really great language access coalition in Hawaii. They work from, like, the local level on up to the state, and especially in dealing with the natives, with the native community that's there. There's a large segment of the community that's LEP, the Limited English Proficient. So I think it's very similar to the D.C. law. My understanding is that the D.C. law is based quite a bit off of what we were saying that was happening in Hawaii, and the Hawaiian law eventually became based off of the D.C. law. But Hawaii is another one, it certainly is, yeah.
And similarly, I would say, I think Washington State has also some very good practices. And again, it's this sort of unity of community groups and participants in the system that are helping to make that possible. So there are often in these states really good practices, coalitions of varying kinds that have really made that possible.
One thing I would also add about California, they also just recently enacted a law outlawing language discrimination specifically. So you don't have to rely on this proxy for national origin language. That's huge, I think, to to like outlaw discrimination on the basis of language is really significant.
Is there any interpreter from the government, free interpreter, in New York City?
That's a great question. So, Misha, do you want to take a crack at that? In terms of a free, so depending on what system you're accessing, there is actually an executive order in New York City that Mayor Bloomberg passed. And again, it's the similar, you know, there's six languages that each agency, each city agency, is supposed to provide services and translation of documents in.
What are the six languages?
The six languages are the ones that are most prevalent in New York City. And again, I'm not sure if I'm going to get all six right, but it's Spanish, Russian, Haitian Creole, Mandarin, and
Italian?
Yes, Italian. Yeah. And then maybe French is the other one. One of those could be wrong. But those are, again, the South Asian community languages are not represented, of course, because, again, it's based on population, but then it's unclear which population census or which data is based around, right? Yeah. And similarly for our communities, I think part of the problem is many of our community members may go to organizations like NJ runs in terms of, you know, local community centers, but are they necessarily going to big agencies without the community centers as well? So how is the data being captured?
Why I asking you? Because I'm a community organizer of Adhikar,
yes.
And we have many people call every day, and we are only three staff over there. Then many work, and we cannot provide in time. And if we cannot provide in time, they are not going to take any benefit. We have a case of for the food stamp. Mm-hmm. If she has time, we do not have time. If we have time, she doesn't have time. So very difficulties. And if we ask for somebody, everybody wants money. In this is time, the economic crisis. Nobody wants to free service. Then we do not have time to every time. So I'm asking.
On that one, so what the agencies should be doing, so the food agency, you should have a phone line, actually, that the caseworker can use and call in, and it has like 180 languages on it, and you can immediately get access. The problem is HRA is the agency, right, in New York, that does this. They're terrible on providing services, which is why often clients will come in with community advocates as their representative, but you, of course, have three people. You don't have time to go with every client. If you're interested, there's actually a potential lawsuit filed against HRA for their language access violations, not by our office, but by another one. And so you can take my card, and
yes.
If your clients are having problems there, they should definitely sort of talk to the attorneys that are looking at this issue.
There is one problem, too, because the I don't mention to her name. She's working for the food stamp, and the only very hard to get her. And if she has in the office, we do not have time. She's only once or 2 days in a week. So this is very difficulties.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where they provide the food stamp, I think their worker is most available for the at least 8 hours. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Absolutely. That is definitely.
It's long time. We try, I think, the 21 days. We didn't meet her.
Absolutely.
And the people are from the diversion visa. They come from the Nepal, and they have a child. They have no job. Then what should I do?
So you're really laying out the profound issues in terms of people's lives and how, you know, because there is not enough capacity in the system, what happens, as well as training. I mean, what we see at public assistance offices as well,
yes,
is that there might be, I think in one office,
there is a line, and it takes long time.
Absolutely. And what we've seen is that, for example, there's one Punjabi speaking person, and so everybody who's Daisy would get referred to that person, regardless of what the language is. And it depends on that person's caseload as well. So there's certainly, but that's definitely an arena where they should be using the language line. Similarly, the court, particularly now in New York State, due to a lot of our advocacy, they passed a court rule called Entitling Language Access in Civil and Criminal Cases both. So again, the courts in New York State, it should be that interpreters provide it. So unfortunately, some of it is not only what legislation or rules are missing, but also the actual training and implementation of these practices. So that's why sometimes the advocacy piece is the potential lawsuit may actually motivate change.
I don't know if anybody here is from outside of Washington or not, but if you are, you may be interested in what we do in Illinois on that same subject.
Yeah, I cannot hear. Yeah,
you may be interested in what we do with the same subject in Illinois, and I'll be very brief. We have a project called the Outreach and Identification Project. It's paid for by the state of Illinois. And under that and we get some funding for that. Under that project, if a client in the process of accessing services with language problems, we are able to help that client with translations at our office. We also man the Illinois Department of Human Services desk one day a month. Granted, it's only one day a month, but at least the people can be directed then on that day to come that day if they have a language problem. And there is the state of set aside funding for that.
That's really helpful.
I'm from Chicago, and I'm from Apnagar. That's also the provide services, multiple services, but specifically for DV survivors. And we have this major staff pool who speak about 19 different languages. Still, we don't have all the languages that we need to provide the services that we are compelled to provide. However, we have with local college, we send all our clients for ESL. We have some kind of confidentiality waiver and agreements and all that. We still have a long way to go. I was sitting once at the local public aid office, and I saw they have everything written and all different, you know, Polish, Spanish, Russian, this and that. Nothing from South Asia. What happened here, you know? But it feels like the information, our rights, it's not everyone is aware. Not everyone has the time. The advocates who are working on that, you know, I know the information. Do I have the time? Do you have the time? No, I mean, the priorities are different. And so community has to really be aware of it and push for it. And we have the rights. It's there. But no one is coming from the government to tell us, you know, you can get this fund from here to do this, this, this. But when you sit a place like that, and they are dealing with food standard, dealing with this and that. Excuse me. So we do have to be very squeaky. You know, squeaky wheel gets the oil. I really believe in that. And if it's a collective squeakiness, I think the result is very good. It's there. It's, you know, ESL programs are wonderful. It's everyone, as Jay mentioned, that there are some specific reasons why the clientels are there to learn English, you know. Who is going to take them, you know, generally? My mom, you know, she speaks very well, but when she's with us, she will be a little hesitant to speak. She lives in a senior building. She is queen of that senior building. And she is talking to everyone. Correct English? No. She can communicate, she can do. And she learned reading from the books, watching TV. I tell all my clients, please watch TV all the time, those, you know. There are ways of doing it, but as far as community-based advocacy effort, we need to, collectively, we need to make the community aware of the rights. And, you know, especially when you go to that kind of place and say, excuse me, I need to have this too. Otherwise, you know, Polish people, when did they start having their own thing? What happened to us? We came here a long time ago, Hindi, Urdu. Is there anything Bangla? When I see anything, because I'm Bengali, I ask, whoa, Bangla, let's look at it. Who did this? You know, that's wonderful. We collectively have to do this.
Well, that's actually really interesting. I'm taking it out of the rights perspective in terms of what you're doing, but the community response of having individuals who are being used as interpreters. Mm-hmm. that's been a tremendous, that's had a tremendous impact in the D.C. area in particular. Our organization, we actually train community interpreters. And a lot of these people, I mean, you know, I think all of us, for example, you know, Pravia asked how many people were bilingual or trilingual in the room. You know, I say that I'm bilingual, but I'm not fully bilingual, not by any stretch. I still have to call my mother and ask her how to say Wednesday in Hindi, you know, when people are calling. I do that all the time. And so, I mean, but at the same time, there are many community members who do step up, and we train them in terms of just exactly what she was saying, like confidentiality issues, when there are conflicts of interest. Because a lot of individuals, we know how our communities are. We know that our community can be really small or can be really big, but even when it's really big, it's really small. And that many people know each other, and that they will know that such and such and such and such is happening to such and such. And all of those things need to be dealt with too. And I think the role of interpreters and how interpreters are really supposed to interact and how they're supposed to be sort of the in-between between, you know, if it's a government agent and the person trying to access services, or even a lawyer and a person trying to access legal services, or even someone coming into, you know, for ESL class, whichever it may be. I think, you know, that community response in terms of developing a community interpreter bank has been really beneficial.
Thank you for sharing that. Then we'll be back.
So I wanted to provide a different angle on this. It's a little bit more historical, a little bit more context, and through a story, and I'm happy to have the panelists respond and comment on that, especially on the part of, like, people in the community being interpreters. And the personal story is, when I immigrated to the U.S. when I was little, my ethnic community was developing. So there weren't established schools for Bangla, for that kind of stuff. Put that in the larger context of even Latino immigrants a couple generations back, they faced overarching cultural pressure from Americans to don't learn your native language, learn English. And so maybe some South Asian communities also kind of felt that context of, oh, we don't have time, we're an immigrant growing community, we don't have time to set up those schools yet, and, oh, by the way, to focus on learning the English really well. Flash forward to now, people like me are in a situation where we want to learn those skills at a high level, you know, both speaking and writing, so we can produce these resources that are needed, but there aren't the resources out there in American society to help us. There are some exceptions. Certain schools like Cornell, Michigan, Harvard, they may have those Sanskrit, South Asian languages, and the State Department does its programs where they pay young people who are current students or going to be students to go to those countries over there like India or Bangladesh or Pakistan to learn these languages, but that's not addressing the immediate need right now. And I'm wondering, when we get to the strategy and the tactical part of the presentation, if we can all talk about, have a bigger conversation about using the people within the community who are available now to do these things.
I love that point, partly because, we were talking earlier before the panel started about how none of us really thought we'd be doing language rights work when we came into doing it, but once you start doing it, you become obsessed with it. And I've been thinking a lot about the role of English as a language in this country, and it's spoken by 98% of the people in the country. The oppressiveness of English and the forcible assimilation that people have to encounter because of the barriers based on language, not just the barriers, but also being told you should abandon your native language. And then what impact does that have on our communities, especially? You know, I'm the same way, where I felt like English was kind of what, you know, we spoke Hindi at home, but then you go out in the world and you speak English. And so then I feel like my language skills have eroded over time. And I'm passionate about language, but I can't speak and write and read Hindi the way I would like to. And what impact does that have on me as a child of immigrants? And what does that have on our communities and the accessibility and services? And I really think that's a great, and into the concept of English privilege in this country and how, as English speakers, we're so privileged is troubling to me. And I think that's a dialogue we haven't started having yet.
And I really think that, you know, kind of going back to, you know, she was talking about intentional discrimination versus disparate impact. You know, intentional discrimination, as Michelle had mentioned, is you're South Asian, sucks to be you, you're not going to get services today. I mean, that's really what it is. But I really think that the manner in which we speak is a new and emerging way of a new way of sort of classifying racism. It's not new, but as the immigrant community gets larger, so too do individuals living in poverty, because new immigrants are sort of going to enter a poverty-stricken situation many times. And so when that happens, these are individuals who are going to be accessing government services, and that creates pejorative connotations applications from outsiders of non-immigrant communities on issues of dependency. And ultimately, these are different, you know, there are things that need to be done in a culturally sensitive way to address, I think, the model minority myth, to address issues of power, all kinds of things. But the ultimate language is this way, is a new method of rate of
celebration.
Yeah, exactly.
On your CV, actually, you know, the organizers of the conference have done such an amazing job. And on your CV, there are definitely 4 or 5 articles on the language access, so you can have further information. What I was just hoping for you to find is the Mexican American Legal Defense Education Fund and the Asian American Justice Center have also done this briefing book on language rights. And what's really interesting is so often the conversation is that immigrants don't want to learn English, and JS talked eloquently about why immigrants do want to learn English. But what this data also shows us is that across different immigrant communities, by the third generation, often there is no native language speaking skill. So by the third generation, there are English speakers, but unfortunately, they're not necessarily fluent, and they're not bilingual anymore. So I think it's really for us to think through this overarching question, which you have raised eloquently in terms of, you know, what is the role of foreign-born residents in the United States, and what is the place of new immigrants? Because I think as this country itself grows and matures, we will have many generations, as we do within our community, but in other communities as well, of residents of the United States, as well as this population of more recent newcomers. And I think, you know, we see even within our own community, sometimes the debates and dialogues and, in fact, challenges across that divide in terms of recent immigrants versus those who have been here for a generation or more. I would also point you to, in terms of other resources, the National Asian Pacific American Bar Association also has information on this particular issue. It has done some work around data on that too. So that might be another reference to look at.
Yeah, can I?
Oh, yeah, please.
On Sterling's mention of the, I think you were quoting from some study, says immigrants do not want to learn anything like that.
Or that's sometimes the perception, right? That people
have a perception.
Yes, that immigrants don't want to learn English. Or
I'll give you an example of my own, and then I'll make the comment on that statement. I had a lot of interest in Spanish foods and wines, and I traveled to Spain several times. And in between a couple of those travels, I spent about a year learning the Spanish language from scratch, and I had no background in Spanish, so that I could communicate better with the vineyard owners or whatever. And it's very hard. I spent the whole year. I can't get by in the bigger cities. Smaller cities are in bigger trouble. But once I got back, you know, I cannot speak to a native speaker. Even somebody who's reasonably good at Spanish and is not a native speaker, I cannot communicate with them, except by gesturing and one or two words here and there. So it is hard. So I don't blame the immigrants or anybody else if they have trouble learning the English language. It's not that they don't want to learn. It's hard. It's very hard to learn a new, brand new language from scratch. And I found that out myself. And we see our clients struggle with that all the time in our ESL classes. And you know, we have all kinds of programs to help them. But it is hard. So if they sometimes throw in the towel, it's because it's hard.
Just in terms of just finishing the fact base about what's out there and what's available or not, this has been very helpful. And I'll ask probably what's a dumb question, but caveat this with I'm a consultant, so it's just in my DNA to ask this following stupid question. I'm a little more familiar with the ESL side, not with the translation services. Has anybody tried to make a market out of this? And, you know, is it, because what I've been wondering listening to this, there's lots of huge unmet needs everywhere, right? And not all of them can be turned into markets for a variety of reasons. And I'm just trying to figure out, particularly on the translation services, as I've heard about this a lot through like works my wife does and lots of other folks I know, is it a thing that's a step away from becoming a market? Or is there really just a, like, we're 9 steps from that because it's too fragmented or whatever? So I want to know if you've heard of anybody successfully trying to provide this as a business.
That's a great question.
So in New York, it's a huge market. And you know, earlier, Corby had mentioned that we had a recent victory related to language access in pharmacies, and all of the major chain pharmacies in New York are now going to improve their language services. That sort of enforcement action has led to some legislative work as well at the local and state level. And our biggest allies and the people who call me most often about how they can support the bill are the translation companies. So LanguageLine, Certified, you know, Language Plus, like all these different companies, small and large, mom and pop shops ranging to like the big corporate entities, are all running around the country lobbying for these different types of bills because there's real money in it for them. And so, you know, I don't know how significant the market is in terms of numbers and kind of whether there could be sort of more penetration, but it is a growing, I mean, I think businesses see this as a growing thing. And so they support our advocacy, which is great for us.
Well, I was even going to think in terms of is the pharmacy able to drive more customers if they're language friendly? So could you get I may have drifted to the second part of the conversation. I apologize if we started talking strategy. But can you, draw in your CVSs or whatever to go behind this? Because you could, if we thought it would bring in more revenue for them, that's what I don't know that industry segment well enough. But if they thought it could bring in more people in the same neighborhood because they're very Hindi friendly, Spanish friendly, whatever the thing is. I don't know if anyone's tried that and it's failed, or we haven't tried it yet.
So it's funny that you bring up CVS and Rite Aid. So our initial two settlement agreements were with CVS and Rite Aid. Rite Aid has come out in front of this, and next week is actually doing some big PR thing in New York to say, look at how language accessible we are. And when I talked to the language service providers, they said that CVS has been more reticent. So it's just they're making different calculations about their business sort of strategy. But there's definitely that calculation that's going in. And as an office, we've tried to use that even when working with hospitals. So we did a big campaign against a network of hospitals in New York that were not providing adequate language services, and initially came in adversarial, but then realized that the hospital was actually trying to do a better job of kind of serving and sort of expanding into the Spanish-speaking and Chinese markets where they were. And so we started being more collaborative. Like, look at the demographics here. You can actually, if you do outreach to these communities, you can bring in more patients, take them away from your competitor hospital. That proved very compelling, and we didn't have to file a complaint. So sometimes that can actually be a really good practice strategy.
Definitely something, you know, which, as you all know, like Western Union, the phone card companies, they're all very good at having telemarketers who speak other languages, and they make calls to community members, right? So this is definitely an arena that the business savvy folks have picked up. I think the problem comes in when you have federal and public agencies, right? Because they don't have the same for-profit business mandate, so they're not necessarily looking at this in a way that these other for-profit companies want.
But couldn't they procure it to meet their mandate? Like, does it have to be federal employees who speak the language, or can they just hire a translator to have them in the room, right?
So. You can absolutely hire an interpreter. One of the issues, though, is that, you know, like I mentioned, I say that I'm bilingual, but I'm not fully bilingual. Mm-hmm. So just having, you know, with some of these translation services, a lot of them are certified interpreters. They have, you know, they've demonstrated a high level of skill, I mean, the highest level of skill, really, in terms of their ability to translate or interpret, to interpret an oral conversation and translate a document. And so that is not easy to find sometimes. I think it's a lot easier to find than we think it is, but it's also very expensive. And so
they'll be at the higher end of the translators.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so from my standpoint, from the government services standpoint, as a language access advocate, I want to make sure that my client who's going in there gets those services. They deserve the best services that the government can provide. And when the government says that they don't have enough money to provide services, excuse my language, that's bullshit. I'm sorry. That's just, you know, we train interpreters in my office. You know, we're a staff of 9, we can train. We train community interpreters. And you can't find me someone who speaks Korean in Annandale, Virginia. That's bullshit. That's just ridiculous. And they're not able to afford that. You know, I found out, Corby and I were in the same meeting on Monday, and we found out that Social Security spends $3.2 million a year, or at least in fiscal year 2008, on interpretation and translation for the entire country, the entire country, Social Security Administration. In Howard County, Maryland, it's a small little county, Howard County, Maryland, their budget is $750,000 a year. you know, on just interpretation and translation. And the Social Security Administration had the gall to say that $3.2 million is enough. And I was floored. I was floored by, you know, and that's not a lot of money for the government. It's just not. And yes, I know the times are tough, but that's just not. And
yeah,
there are.
Right. They probably have, I don't know how many Social Security offices. There must be, the amount per office is probably low. So, but that's something that could be addressed legislatively.
Oh, absolutely.
That you can push money down with conditions. So.
Absolutely. But I mean, in terms of accessing a qualified, certified interpreter, that can be difficult to do because it is very expensive to access. This, which is why some of these sort of community interpreter banks are popping up the way that they are.
I know we're starting to get actually, and the conversation is just heating up. Nisha, I know you'll be like on the dot soon, but I want to continue the conversation. I feel like we're just starting to get energy in terms of it. So I'm hoping people can stay 5-10 minutes later, and that way we can really flesh out the conversation, especially since you had those cookies to begin with. So we have a little bit more time. And Nisha, you have to leave.
So I'm really sorry, because I really love talking about this, but I planned everything very poorly. But I'm going to leave my cards here, and I would love to hear from you, especially about the HRA problem, but in general, I would love to hear from you if you have any questions about language access in the healthcare setting. So I'm very, very sorry.
And I know you've been wanting to...
Yes.
For advocates, you know, how do you know how much, what is the government's responsibility and how much they should be spending? Not should be spending, but in other words, you know, to be able to go to the hospital, because I think what ends up happening is, and I've worked with a lot of small community-based organizations that are Somali organizations, police organizations, and they end up doing government's job because their staff, as the situation you pointed out, certain government agencies, you know, will just repeatedly call on their staff and expect, well, I don't need to get an interpreter because, you know, so-and-so is going to come with the client to the appointment. And they're doing it for free. And so how can, you know, what is the information that will empower the community-based organization to be able to say, no, this is your job, and let me tell you where it says this is your job, and you have to find the money to do X, Y, or Z?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Can you start actually by talking about how you got the contract in terms of being funded to do the work? Because I think, you know...
Are we speaking to outreach and...
Yes, exactly. Can you talk about the genealogy of that?
It is an organization of organizations. It's essentially a policy type of organization, but its members are mostly drug service providers. And it's called ICER. It stands for Illinois Coalition of Immigration and Refugee Rights. Essentially, immigrant rights type of organization. And they have been working with the state in the past, and they've been able to, with lobbying and other things, they're able to do things that we are not, as a direct service provider, are not able to do. There are certain political things we can't do. They're able to do all those things. They have been able to provide, get the state to fund two different programs. One is the outreach and interpretation project. Again, this is somebody to know. So the ONI project I've already described that briefly, where we help clients who are trying to access services and are having language problems. We're able to help them with translations, be it in person at our office of a document, be it on the phone talking to a Illinois Department of Human Services operator or something, or be it at the IDHS's offices one day a month. So in several different ways. Plus we work with 18 or 20 different agencies at the federal, state, and local levels to help them get the benefits that they are entitled to by law. So that's one project. The other project is called the NAI project, and that stands for NAI. It has to do with citizenship. I can't remember what the NAI stands for, but it has to do with citizenship. So here in that, and we also are part of that and get some funding. Here we are able to help clients with several things. The objective is to become a citizen, but we are able to help them with filing for various applications. We're able to help them with the English as a second language classes, and we're able to help them with civics learning the civics of the United States, but that's part of the requirement of it. Now, there's other funding as well, but there's a small funding from here that helps primarily with the application and the other things that are important. So those are the two things, and that's how it started.
Is it New Americans Initiative?
Yes.
New Americans. One of the, I think also though, from just like an advocacy standpoint and like an organizing standpoint, that goes back to the vitality of services. That if they're, you know, in D.C. it's called vital, you know, if it's a vital service or a vital document, in my mind everything is a vital service, everything's a vital document. If you're trying to access some sort of benefit from the government, you should be able to get it. End of story. That should just be how it is. If you need an interpreter in court, if you're calling the police, if whatever this, you know, if you were a DV survivor and you were calling the police, you damn well better get someone who speaks Punjabi on the phone. It's just absurd that you can't. And so it's not difficult to do either. And so I think it goes back to the vitality of services, because I think when you show someone that, you know, they're not able to get their food stamps because they didn't understand what this notice said, or this person's going to jail, which is what happened to one of my clients, because they did not provide an interpreter, and then 4 days later they realized they got the wrong guy. You know, he was in jail for 4 days. But, you know, when those things happen, when my client was not able to get her Social Security benefits for 7 months, 7 months that she was entitled to, because they did not provide her an interpreter, and they said someone else has your Social Security number, we're going to give her the benefits instead. I think it goes back to showing the vitality of those services. And if you can show that they're vital services, you show that this has a significant impact on the day-to-day life of an average individual, then they have to be able to provide those services. They have to.
I think this is, again, where, too, if the organizations that you're working with can work together. I think so often, and again, we need to do direct services because that's what the need is. But when we don't use our day-to-day ground-level expertise to do organizing or policy advocacy, then unfortunately the services continue to be bad and they continue to have the same barriers day in and day out. So one of the reasons that we in New York were able to get a lot of change at the state level in terms of the court system is because we worked with a coalition of other DV advocates. I co-chair an initiative called Justice Speaks. But not only did we have advocates in the coalition, we had attorneys, we had interpreters, and we had think tanks as well. So we had a very diverse group of people who were looking at this issue from multiple lenses. And that way we could craft, you know, actual recommendations that were based on a sense of the whole field and what was needed across these various constituencies. So I know, for example, a lot of interpreters are, you know, very concerned around the idea of community interpretation because they feel like it is a profession with skills and that, you know, it's important to have that professionalization. And also that those who are staff members at agencies that are community-based agencies are advocates for the community members. They're not necessarily a neutral interpreter in a court system. So I think, you know, as we progress in terms of strategy, these are some of the complicated questions that also come out, even as a lot of these strategies are really fundamental in terms of actually delivering on access to services. So I think in terms of approaching agencies on a concrete level, I think it has to be a mix of, you know, trying to build partnerships within that agency. Because for us, you know, I've just heard from our two advocates that they haven't faced any language access issues in the courts in the last year. And that's because we were such a pain for 10 years before that. So, you know, we would directly call the Office of Court Administration and the person who was in charge of interpreting and managing that. So I think it's both the micro doing the, you know, actual day-to-day work and, you know, doing the provision of services when you can, because that's the only thing that you can do, building partnerships within agencies, and then really rallying for change and doing research and advocacy hand in hand.
And with some of that research, I think if, you know, government agencies are supposed to have language access plans, even if you're in a state that doesn't necessarily have a language access law. I think if you contact, you know, that's one of the first things that I did when I was learning, because I really knew nothing about language access before, I think, you know, until after I became a lawyer. I learned about it because it was part of a prerequisite for my job, and I basically lied in my interview and said that I totally knew about it. And I came to, like, learn about it later. I'm all over it. Yeah. But basically, I mean, the way that I started to really, really get a hold of it was, I went, I called the constituent offices of the different, you know, of the Maryland state government. There's, you know, the Office on Asian Pacific Islander Affairs here, and here in D.C., the Office of Latino Affairs. And I asked them, what is the government supposed to do? And I think if you were able to sort of look at that language access plan, and a lot of it, I mean, it's, you'd be, one thing that I have to admit is that, you know, in government, you will find many people who do understand the problem and just really don't know what they can internally do to fix it. And there are so many well-intentioned, wonderfully intentioned people, actually, who do understand what's going on and know that this is a problem and are just, you know, really, because of the red tape that is government, essentially, are just not really able to do as much as they want to do. But they know what's going on and they know what the law is, and they are looking for people. They are looking for community-based organizations to help them. And they're looking for community-based organizations to look at those language access sort of plans and the law itself, or just kind of like what their strategy should be, and be like, all right, can you tell us what to do? And so there is a lot of that, that sort of, you know, exactly what Cordy was saying, that sort of, you know, the government and community-based organizations working together, that happens a lot with language access in particular, actually. So, I mean, I think if we're all aware, I mean, it's exactly what Nisha said. When you start doing this, you become obsessed. When I'm on the bus, I look at everything like, that should be translated, that should be translated, that should be translated. I'll be on the metro and I'll be like, that sign should be translated. I'll be in the post office and be like, that should be translated. And when they call out, like, number 10, they should say it in six languages. You know, like, I'm literally thinking about that constantly. But be mindful of that. When I first learned about human trafficking, that was the first thing I did. I'd be like, is that person trafficked? Is that person trafficked? I mean, I'm basically conducting racial profiling. If you are aware of what's going on, you know, look out and see what's happening in your community, and be aware of what's happening.
Okay. So we have time for one more question.
Okay. Just to play devil's advocate, like, at what point does it become inefficient to convert so many languages, right? So, like, are you going to have 100 different languages on the walls? Or are you going to, someone going to say six and, you know, when they call out a number in 10 different languages? At what point does it become unfeasible and inefficient?
I think the point that immigration stops. I don't really see that happening anytime soon.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately, yeah. The minute the borders officially close.
I think that's a great practical question. Yeah. Because I think Nadia is giving the ethical.
Yeah. Right.
And the sort of practical cost question. I think that's actually an arena where a lot of agencies are thinking about technology and how technology can make some of this more effective and efficient. And again, DOJ would agree with you because reasonability is definitely one of the considerations, right? Which is, again, why we see six languages as opposed to 190 plus, you know. So, for example, you know, the Department of Motor Vehicles is thinking through, like, what kind of signage and billboards should it have? Should it be, like, rolling tickers? You know, should it be... So how can you actually do this, right, in a way that lives up to the ethical mandate and the practical mandate as well? So it's a great question. And again, I think those are some of the brainstorming areas that advocates, people with technology experience, are going to have to work together in terms of crafting really viable responses.
You know, in D.C., there's the Department of Corrections, for example, is their language access plan is one of the best I've ever seen. It is, I mean, it's phenomenal because literally, I mean, they're inmates. So many of their inmates don't speak English. So, I mean, they really, really need to be on top of their stuff. And the guy who's the head of the DOC here, Department of Corrections here, in their language access plan, they talk exactly about what Corby just mentioned, the technology thing that's happening. And there is a device, there's a handheld device that they have come across. And it's apparently fairly inexpensive, but you can program, I think it's 370 phrases, just, you know, common usage phrases in a prison, for example. And there are many common usage phrases in a prison, of line up and you know, whatever it may be. And this handheld device can spit it out in 160 languages, like instantaneously. Well, I mean, I don't know the full details of it. I think you have to say Persian or Farsi, you know, something comes out. But it's a miraculous tool. If that could be used, if I could use that in legal services, I'd be all over that.
So, Jay, do you want to, I feel like maybe if you guys want to have any closing comments, and then I can just wrap up in terms of, you know, what we talked about. And just...
Sure. First of all, I'd like to thank Salt. I think they did an excellent job of putting this conference together, and very well organized, very well done. So I don't know if I can hear Salt, but Thank you.
I think this is being recorded in podcast, probably, so. And we have a volunteer who's been taking notes as well.
So thank you very much, Tussaud. As to the language access issue, from our standpoint, I would say that if anybody's thinking about it or is doing it, what I call ESL plus, meaning it's not just ESL, because that by itself is not very meaningful. Think about the life goals that your clients have and try to go ESL plus so that they can accomplish their life goals, be it employment or talking to their sons or their kids' teacher, any of those type of things. So then keep that in mind.
Thanks again, Tussaud, and for Purvi. Purvi is kind of, she doesn't speak about herself enough, but she's really the pioneer of a lot of this, and she'd get a lot of the credit for what's going on with the language access movement. But I'm very good at explaining the problem, at knowing what the problem is, and I never focus a lot on the solutions, of really explaining the solutions. And there's a lot of work that's being done, a lot of good grassroots work that's happening, obviously, in this room. But there are language access coalitions all over the country, in almost every state, really. It's just, it's happening all over the place. Get involved. Find out what's happening in your state, in your county, whichever it may be, and see if there are ways for you to get involved. And trust me, there are thousands of ways for you to get involved. This is not an issue that's just going to affect the immigrant community. And this in D.C., they found in the 2006-2007 school year of D.C. public schools, of the LEP students, and there's 8,192 LEP students, according to the 2006-2007 American Communities Survey Service. 51% of them are U.S. citizens. So this is not just an issue of the immigrant community. This is an emerging issue. This is an emerging American issue. And so, find ways to get involved. And, I think it just kind of goes back to some of the tips. Be mindful of what's happening in your community. Ask your government. Government, trust me, loves to talk about what they do. Lawyers do. So, find out what's going on. Ask about those plans. If there isn't a plan, tell them they need a plan.
So I wanted to thank my very sweet co-panelists and speakers for all the amazing information that you shared, and of course, in addition to had to leave, unfortunately. And you guys have been an amazing audience. Thank you for your incredible question. So I would just leave you with a couple of points to think about in terms of as we go forward. So we've covered basically some of the framework in terms of the barriers that limit English proficiency in individual space. We didn't speak too much actually around the deaf hard of hearing community, which is also part of the language access issue. So I wanted to make sure that we didn't discuss that or just mention that briefly. So obviously there's a whole host of barriers. We've heard somewhat about the legal framework. We've heard some about the innovative responses that we've seen from on the ground. The ESL Plus, which is a fantastic concept, the community interpreter bank, as well as advocacy and coalitions, and really making concrete legislative change happen, as well as some of the complex resource challenges and how we can continue to problem solve around this issue. So I'll just refer you to a couple of associations that work on it on a professional basis as well, again, as interpreters and translators, and that's the American Translators Association, ATA, and I think it's just ata.org, as well as, if you're interested particularly in the court system that we are, the National Association of Judiciary Interpreters and Translators. Which is definitely a mouthful, so I'll say it again, the National Association of Judiciary Interpreters and Translators. And their website is magic.org. So both of these, again, professional associations have a whole host of information about some of the issues that you spoke to today. So thank you so much for your amazing engagement. There are a couple of materials from our organization on the side. Feel free to take, and if you have questions, please feel free to come up and speak to our panel.
One more quick resource is the National Language Access Advocates Network.
Yes,
and Lynn.
I think it's .org.
But if you do NLAND and Google it,
yeah.
NLAAN, the National Language Access Advocates Network. NLAAN. The National Language Access Advocates Network. I feel like they're entirely housed in New York.
.org.
I believe it is. If you actually just Google NLAN, it'll come up for sure. But just a great group of individuals who are not really in any way connected. But yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.